You mustn't sneeze at babka. You mustn't sneeze at tea and sympathy. We have to humanize one another. The irony of the world in which we live is that this superabundance of communication has actually distanced us from one another. We don't listen to one another. We don't hear other views. We plug in only to those that are feeding our own prejudices, and we don't know one another. That leads to a worse world. That leads to a world in which we are greater victims, and we are even victims of our own narrow-mindedness.
Welcome to Crossing Faiths, the largest multi-faith podcast out there. And we started as the first Muslim Christian podcast. And we're very lucky today to have Rabbi David Rosen here, a senior staff member at the AJC, and worked very hard in the Abrahamic House, who's speaking to us from Israel. Regionally, I reached out to talk about anti-Semitism, but this conversation is talked more about peacemaking and all the other elements that might be out there when it comes to multi-faith engagement. Thank you, Rabbi, for joining me.
Great pleasure to be with you.
So you're in Israel right now.
I'm in my home in Jerusalem, yes. I have been going back and forward to Abu Dhabi, but that's a little bit less now. But I'm still serving as a special advisor to the Abrahamic Family House.
So Abrahamic Family House, for some of our listeners, maybe you could just give a brief on what that is and what that is about.
With pleasure. I'd be happy to give a non-brief one as well. Doing my best to try to be as concise. First of all, there's a broader background. The broader background are initiatives, not just in the UAE, but even starting in Saudi Arabia in the wake of September the 11th, 2001, to try to combat the hijacking of Islam by extremist elements, recognizing that extremism poses a threat first and foremost to the Arab monarchies, and only afterwards, if you like, to the rest of the world. And so initiatives took place, and I would say that the UAE, even though it wasn't the first, quickly became the most prominent in terms of trying to combat hate, online manipulation, radicalization, both, if you like, through security tools, but also through what you might call soft power weapons. And one of the most significant things that the UAE did, maybe the most significant, was to bring Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayer to reside in Abu Dhabi and to establish what was originally called the Forum for the Promotion of Peace in Muslim Lands, is now known as the Abu Dhabi Peace Forum, as well as to be able to prepare future generations of Islamic leadership that would articulate his vision of noble, enlightened, authentic Islam, to be able to combat its abuse by extremist elements. And so a number of initiatives took place. Today, there are actually three government ministries in the UAE working in this field in different ways. There's a Ministry of Tolerance, the Ministry of Interior has an interfaith alliance looking to be able to combat radicalization online, to create what they call safer communities. And the foreign ministry is also involved in certain ways, but it's really the government of Abu Dhabi involved in a big way behind Sheikh bin Bayer and the different operations. And it was the Abu Dhabi that hosted the visit of Pope Francis in 2019. And for that occasion, Sheikh Ahmed bin Tayyib, Ahmed Al Tayyib, the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, specifically initiated the idea of having a summit that he would attend together with that he would have a summit that would be that he and the Pope would attend, at which they would issue a declaration on human fraternity, calling for not only fraternity and mutual respect between Muslims and Christians, but all the religions of the world. To tell the truth, Ahmed Al-Tayyib had tried to do that when the Pope visited Egypt, but hadn't succeeded in doing it in Egypt because the Egyptian context was far less hospitable. Now he had the opportunity in the UAE to do it, and the leadership of the UAE, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, de facto at the time, because his brother still was nominally the ruler, but he was, in as I say, in effect the ruler, agreed with alacrity to host this particular summit. At this, in the Declaration of Human Fraternity, actually was, for I think, acquired quite a significant echo, if you like, around the world. The first time ever two leaders of such stature had issued such a call. Sheikh Ahmed Al-Tayeb had proposed the idea of building both a mosque and a church alongside one another as a testimony of friendship between Muslims and Christians. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed said, and what about the Jews? This is Abrahamic, we need to have a synagogue as well. And the Pope and Ahmed Al-Tayeb agreed, but it wasn't, the initiative didn't come from them, it came from Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, which is very interesting. It shows an outlook, an approach, which was very embracing and pluralistic. And indeed, the UAE, and in particular Abu Dhabi, has become a host to other religious places of worship and diversity, and probably may be described fairly as the most pluralistic place in the whole of the Muslim world, Arab Muslim world today, certainly within the Arab Muslim world, if not beyond. And so in order to be able now to promote that particular vision, a tender was issued to architects around the world. And there was a wonderful competition that eventually was won by Sir David Ajaya, a Brit of Ghanaian origin. And this complex was opened February a year ago. It is an exquisitely beautiful complex. Basically, it's three, from a distance, it looks like three similar cubes. But when you get up closer, you can see that the cubes are different. Each one is, I suppose, 100 or 200 yards apart from the other. You can enter any one. Let's say you want to go to pray in the mosque on a Friday. You won't even be aware that there's a synagogue and a church there, unless you walked around the broader perimeter and saw the symbols of the three different places of worship. So what's important about that is that each place of worship has its own integrity. There's no attempt to try to create some kind of something syncretistic. Each one is respected in terms of its own authentic particular tradition. And the mosque is a traditional Sunni mosque that comes under, if you like, the authority of Al-Azhar, because through Al-Azhar they've appointed the imam there. The church is a traditional Catholic church through under the authority of the Vatican, and through the Vatican's authority, they've appointed a priest there. And the synagogue, you know the joke, two Jews, three opinions. Who does the synagogue come under? So at least it's formally registered, defined as a modern Orthodox synagogue. And part of my role has been helping them get the rabbi whom we installed formally about a month ago into that particular position. Okay. So there's a community there. The mosque and the church are incredibly successful. I think they're built to seat something like 400, 450 people, and they have been getting sometimes in the height, if you like, in the cool season, relatively there, as many as 800, both in the mosque and in the church. And they've had to provide outside air conditioning facilities to be able to accommodate all of them. The synagogue is a little more of a challenge. You've got less Jews in Abu Dhabi than you have Muslims and Christians. And from a point of view of an Orthodox synagogue, you need to be able to have people resident, or at least within the vicinity in walking distance, for Sabbath observance. So that's a bit of a challenge, but they've managed to be able to have regular services on Sabbath. And now with a rabbi there, that's working well. Now, part of it is just the very existence of these three houses of worship together. They are connected by a forum. The forum serves both as a conference center and exhibition center. So you've got thousands of people from all over the world coming and visiting these three houses of worship. Many of them never been into a house of worship of another faith. And at the same time, they go through an exhibition area, which introduces them more to areas of worship, to sight and sound within these three particular traditions, which is wonderful. And and in addition, it also has facilities, obviously, the administration and the office facilities there. On top is a garden, which during the winter months operates a cafe there. And you have young Emiratis coming with their families, drinking coffee, especially in the evening, a background of a mosque, a church, and a synagogue, all taking as totally natural as it shouldn't be any other way. And that's really wonderful. But in addition to that, the center through the forum is providing a program of interfaith activity, both activities that bring people from different faiths together. So you'll have a book club, an art group, painting, children's activities, different areas, and people from different communities come together. So it's a meeting place of people, different community, even without there being any specific interreligious agenda. But it's also a place where there is, and there will be even more in the future, interfaith programming that's purpose is to be able to look at contemporary issues from the perspective of different religions. And for COP28, there were programs that focused on sustainability and the different religious perspectives. So this is, I would say, the most remarkable multi-faith complex, Abrahamic multi-faith complex in the world. And it's part of its great significance is not only that you've got these three houses of worship functioning alongside one another, but you have these tens of thousands of visitors from all over the world coming to a place which they probably wouldn't even inquire to be able to know more about the different religious traditions if it wasn't for such an opportunity. And that combats prejudice and misunderstanding and bigotry. And they learn that it's very like a culture of mutual respect. In addition to that, this complex on Saadiyat Island, you know, Abu Dhabi is an archipelago, so it's lots of different islands. And this island of Saadiyat has on it the Louvre. It will soon, or soon, the Guggenheim will be completed. It has its National Zayed Museum, its Museum of Natural History, its Museum of Science. And amidst all these are these three houses of worship, emphasizing what's a very important message, that religion, science, art, culture, they are all interwoven, which is a very important message also to communicate. And many people would come to the Louvre to see an art exhibition because the Abrahamic family houses next door will go in to be able to see it. So it's educational value without. I once met a man who said to me that the role of religions in our world today should be to preach without preaching, which I thought was rather a nice comment. And in that sense, the Abrahamic family house preaches without preaching. It gives people the idea that religion should not only be central and integral part of our lives, but should be able to embrace diversity and mutual respect.
I think I have a question about how I appreciate the overview and I appreciate the insight. Not only that, is that you're enthusiastic about the initiative and the physical place and what its outcomes and outputs are, right? So the social worth and in international development, human rights, we talk about the social worth. There may not be ROI as far as financial, but there's a lot of social worth to something like this, right? And so you mentioned earlier about Egypt. You tried this in Egypt. You have places like Erbil, one of the oldest inhabited cities on the planet, and you have the ministry in the Kurdish ministry has offices for all of the different faith groups in Erbil. And so there's the existence of these collaborative environments where everyone has been living with each other. But of course you have the backdrop in like something like place like Erbil where you have war and you have conflict and you also have sort of the practicality of life. Do you think the opportunity in Abu Dhabi, the opportunity in Abraham's house is that it's a new footprint. It's a new, not that there hasn't been multi-faith there, but the idea of the Sheikh Zayed making the statement, verbalizing it, and being able then to take that statement and figure out a way to practically implement that in a place where you don't have the backdrop of such a long history of conflict. Do you think that was a factor or?
No, I exactly do think that. I think it's a little bit more than that, because even when we've had, and there have been great periods, historic periods of creative collaboration between Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, nevertheless, they've always been on somebody else's terms. In other words, there's always been the chief honcho that could be tolerant and respectful of other traditions as well, as long as they know their place. Obviously, there is here an indigenous culture, an indigenous religious faith. Yet nevertheless, the whole approach is one in which no one tradition is given any sense that it's inferior in any way in terms of its status. But it's really a genuine meeting on an even, if you like, playing ground and of mutual respect. And I think that's really quite novel. You've got a couple of such initiatives in Europe that I'm aware of in modern times. But then the other problem for them is that they don't have organic living religious communities alongside one another. Very often they're museums. And this place is not just a museum. This is actually a living organism. So it's a rather unique combination. And I do think that it offers a remarkable footprint. Unfortunately, most societies which are liberal enough to envisage this kind of diversity and pluralism are too secular to be able to appreciate the enormity and the potential. Mm-hmm. And it's very rare to be able to find a society that is inherently religious that appreciates the value and the importance of diversity. I would say that's authentically Quranic, incidentally, because you, of course, will be aware of the famous verse in Al-Hujurat in the Quran about that talks of having created humanity from a single man and a woman, made us into tribes and nations in order to know one another. In other words, the authentic religious expression should be one that genuinely respects the other. And I think this is something that it's a pity that Islam in most places and times never lived up to this ideal that the Quran articulates. But it's something that I think that Judaism, Christianity have to learn to appreciate fully as a religious value.
Yeah, well, I talked a little bit about babka diplomacy. You know, you got to socialize. You know, if you that's the one of the keys is to
absolutely
interaction. You know, over something that's familiar. You know,
and actually, I must say to the credit of Pope Francis and Imam Al-Tayeb, that's precisely the message of the Document of Human Fraternity. It doesn't get into really deep theological issues. It's a matter of just let's look one another in the eye and discover one another's humanity.
Yeah, we I have a little bakery cafe that I do business out of, and I learned how to make babka in Russia. And a day ago, we have the temple up a town, a temple Emmanuel. They have a new rabbi, and so we do. The temple uses my babka as a fundraiser. So they I give them a good price, and then they sell it as a fundraiser for the temple. So one of the parishioners, one of the members of the community came, and Cindy Silver, and she came to celebrate. I opened up a new location, and she brought the rabbi in to meet me to chat because we have a new rabbi. And she's like, so what's going on here? And I go, what do you mean? She goes, well, you know, you're a Muslim who makes babka. What's going on? I go, I'm a New Yorker. I grew up in a Jewish community, but I learned how to make it in Russia. And I go, you know, it's, if you know the babka, you know me. It's kind of this amorphous sort of thing, right? Chocolate. And it takes time to dedicate into building, you know, baking the babka. And so we talked a little bit about that, but the member of the community felt compelled to bring the rabbi in to meet me with the rabbi. And so, but it's, what's the pretense? The pretense is food, right? It's a social element. And I said, well, we'll go for coffee and cake when we have time, because we're trying to do whatever. And you're the physical embodiment of a location. And that was my question about the when you said, well, the attendance at the temple is low. I go, is there a cafe at the temple? Because he started making sandwiches. You know, you had a little coffee and cake, maybe you get more people, you know? So, but I think the physical embodiment, the location, you know, words into something that's tangible, that's working. I think a lot of people that are listening will say, well, you know, is it just a super happy, fantastic place where you have this sort of pretense of tolerance, but there's no action, there's no real action there. Maybe you could talk about, speak to the places of worship. You have active places of worship, but it's also coupled with a substantial administration to have programming there, but export multi-faith goodwill globally. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
That certainly is the vision, but I think that the leadership of the Abrahamic Family House has been very careful not to try to run before it can walk, and has tried from the first year to ensure that it establishes the houses of worship as authentic houses of worship of each tradition. that there can be no accusation of syncretism or of weak religion or creating a new religion, all this nonsense that some critics actually have actually leveled against the Abrahamic family house, and therefore to defend themselves against fundamentalist extremists from all religions. In fact, they've had some of the major criticism come from some Christian fundamentalists with regards to the Abrahamic family house. So that's really been really important. It's also, as I say, an opportunity for meeting for the UAE. This is first and foremost a UAE institution. They want young Emiratis to grow up knowing the other religious traditions, being familiar with them, neither feeling threatened nor ignorant and alienated from them. That's really important for the UAE's own future. And in addition to that, the UAE, because of what Abu Dhabi and Dubai are today, hosts millions of visitors from all over the world, and therefore it can serve as an educational focus for the world at large, and therefore sees itself as having a mission to preach this worldview of religious pluralism for the benefit of the world at large. Yes, the AFH, the Abrahamic Family House, is already getting involved in global activities of area, and its main desire is to help empower those already working in the field and to also to be able to serve in the future as a valuable resource. But that will take time. That's a stage in which they're building up slowly but surely, and I think in a very wise fashion. But if people are skeptical about it, I would say it gets back to what you said before. I mean, you mustn't sneeze at babka. You mustn't sneeze at tea and sympathy. We have to humanize one another. The worst thing is the irony of the world in which we live is that this superabundance of communication has actually distanced us from one another. We don't listen to one another. We don't hear other views. We plug in only to those that are feeding our own prejudices, and we don't know one another. That leads to a worse world. That leads to a world in which we are greater victims, and we are even victims of our own narrow-mindedness. And therefore, anything that brings people together to recognize the humanity of the other, to be able to humanize the other's tradition, is of enormous practical value. I really resent those that say we don't do just dialogue. Dialogue can never be just if it's authentic dialogue. Dialogue means discovering the divinity within each and every human person created by the one source of all, God's blessing, and that no one tradition can encapsulate the totality of the divine. But when I encounter the sense of the other in the spirit of the divine in her or his life, world, and experience, I have the opportunity to encounter the divine presence beyond the confines of my own tradition. That's an incredible gift, and this center gives that amazing gift for people. I should also note that it's the only time in history ever that a non-Jewish government has built a synagogue for a Jewish community. And incidentally, it's about the only synagogue in which you can't become a member and you can't make a donation because it's owned by the government. And the government provides for the Shabbat dinners that take place there as well. If you talk about utilizing food incentives, that's a very significant one. So it's really so historic in so many ways.
You know, I'm going to go backwards to go forwards. So you can hear the enthusiasm, you can hear the passion. You know, this is something that's been a hallmark of your career. I've spent most of my life on multi-faith engagement and collaboration, cooperation. What's the source for you? Where does this come from? Why is this your passion? What motivates you, and where does it come from? Is there a point of critical mass? You know, like with me, I grew up in a multi-faith community. My mother would always say, when you go over to your Jewish friend's house, you're a Jew. When you go over to your Christian, you know, that's how she kind of, you know, she would just create that identity whenever you ask, well, what's this about? She's like, well, you are one when you're there. You know, it's like, so that's, and then I have, like I said, come from a multi-faith family, but what's the catalyst that led you to this, not only this identity, but this, you know, your life's work is this multi-faith peacemaking?
I didn't have the benefit of growing up within a multicultural environment like you, but I had the benefit of growing up within a very secure, deeply rooted, and yet very open-minded environment. My late father, who died when I was only 10 years old, was a famous rabbi in Britain, an unusually gifted, charismatic, deeply spiritual man, who left his position as chief rabbi of the Federation of Synagogues at a relatively early age to establish the first Jewish public school. You know, of course, in Britain, a public school is a private school. And it was known, to, if you like, the kind of Jewish Eton. And the whole idea was to be able to create an institution that was not simply an educational institution in terms of providing data, but educational in terms of providing experience and the spiritual dimensions of identity and enrichment. And I grew up in a home in which being deeply Jewish was never, ever presented as something that was in conflict with being a citizen of the world and part of other cultures as well. On the contrary, one would enrich the other. So I'm really blessed to have grown up in that environment. And you know, Saint Ignatius of Loyola, say, give me a child for the first 7 years and I will show you the man. I can see how much I'm the product of my first years of that particular environment. But then I've also been incredibly gifted by Providence, by the Almighty, because I came to study in Jerusalem and I got my rabbinic ordination. I was brought out to South Africa, where there I worked its struggle against apartheid and to advance social justice, which in the end led to the government having enough of me. But one of the ways that I got involved in this was precisely through interfaith engagement. So I got involved in interfaith engagement out of a commitment to social justice. But as I got involved in it, I realized it was incredibly important. I was stunned to discover that the pastors, the bishops, and the imams and the sheikhs that I was involving in this initiative were incredibly ignorant about me. Not only did they not know about me, they had all kinds of misconceptions and I would say negative stereotypes about me. And I realized it was enormously important for me to engage them. If I want to be safe and I want my community to be safe, I need to be known. But I discovered at the same time that I was pretty ignorant about them too. And I had all kinds of misconceptions, and I was also the victim of stereotypes. And if I want to be understood, I need to understand. So I got more and more involved in this area, and I realized how enormously important it was. I also realized that we have so many profound values that we share. If we share the sense of the transcendent in the world, the dignity of the human person, the sanctity of the family, don't we have an obligation to work together with those who believe in those values? If we don't work together, aren't we betraying those values in effect? And how can we advance peace in the world if we don't really apropos that surah, that text in the Quran, which I quoted before, which I didn't know at the time, but I know very well now. How can we really advance well-being in the world if we don't know one another? So I became really hooked on it. Then after that, when I was chief rabbi of Ireland, one of my predecessors said 95% of Ireland's Catholic, 5% Protestant, and I'm chief rabbi of the rest. It's a little bit of an exaggeration, of course, because when I was there, there were more Jews in the Irish Parliament than there were Protestants, even though there were 100 times as many Protestants and Jews and Jewish Lord Mayors of the major cities. And in fact, Israel, the only country to have given Israel both a president and a chief rabbi, is Ireland. And the present president of Israel is actually the grandson of the first chief rabbi of Ireland and the son of the sixth president of Israel. So Ireland has got a pretty good record. But at any rate, the result of that is that I got more and more. There weren't at that time, we're talking 40 years ago, there weren't that many Orthodox rabbis that cared passionately about interfaith relations. I'm told that during the Second World War, they used to say, join the army and see the world. I found a much nicer way of seeing the world, join interfaith. I got to wonderful places, met fabulous people and felt enormously enriched. And ever since I got into this field, there is nothing I could dream of that gives me more sense of satisfaction, enrichment, and spiritual inspiration than being involved in encountering other people of faith and working together with other people and bringing that back into my community so that my community can hopefully, like all communities, be cured from the plagues of isolationism, insularity, and prejudice, which unfortunately affect us all. So this for me, people often say, don't you ever get disappointed? I mean, so many bad things happen. Look what's happened, the situation in Israel today, and that's extremely depressing. Of course, there are depressing realities, but I'm never disappointed because there's always so much goodness that I encounter continuously, so much that is wonderful in our world, so much sense of the divine and the transcendent. And I've been given this incredible blessing to be able to encounter it in so many places within different traditions.
I appreciate you sharing that with us because it's a lot of people will say, well, why be in the business of multi-faith, you know, and it's all feel good. You know, there's a lot of multi-faith conversations going, but if it translates to actual building a community and the innovation of what you're doing right now in Abu Dhabi, in the UAE, and you know, you said before, you know, we don't want to put the cart before the horse. We want to make sure that we build a community that has an integrity within not only the faith groups but as a whole before it starts interfacing in it with the world. And so you kind of did that yourself. You came from you didn't come from a multi-faith background. So then you started socializing and branching out because you had that integrity of you knowing who you are and what you're about.
Exactly.
And so I say that a lot to people. I know who I am and what I'm about. Now I can proceed. I'm not trying to change somebody because I'm not sure who I am. What's the so what and what now? You have a flourishing, wonderful facility that's multi-faith. The community is building. There's a lot of products that have come out of that. One of that is we spoke about before we started recording the MNMNMN film. I've spoken about it a lot and worked very hard at that with Tom Gallagher and the Religion Media Company. And so working on the sequel now. And so that's something that's out there, right? And you know, you have a Christian and a Muslim. That was Tom Gallagher's Catholic and I'm a Muslim working on it. And I'm Shia, right? So which is a whole nother song and dance. So we kind of worked together to raise the funding and get that out there. What's the plan? What's the next thing that's happening within the Abrahamic House that you see as the biggest value to not only internally with the community but externally to the multi-faith agenda? The multi-faith.
I think, as we mentioned before, the next stage is to be able to bring that vision to the world at large in wise ways. And that's, the AFH shouldn't be just another interfaith initiative, as important as all interfaith initiatives are, but not one that's simply competing with others in a common marketplace. It should have a qualitative edge in which others working in the field can see the AFH as an institution that helps empower its own work in many different ways. And I hope that the AFH will also be able to serve as a resource so that my vision, which I hope will be shared by the others there, but I don't make the final decisions there. I'm only an advisor. I'm not the director. Would be that we would have a resource center there that if we wanted to have any document from any branch of any of the three religions dealing with the relationship to the other or with the involvement and contemporary issues of science and society. So if you're dealing with the questions of the environment, or dealing with questions of genetic engineering, you will be able to have the perspectives from the different religious traditions serve as a resource for you. If you wanted to know who's working on trying to address the question of climate change from a religious perspective from the different religions, you would have a resource there where you will be able to go to. So to have, therefore, a universal bank for those all working in the field of interfaith relations, as well as helping empower, but I think in particularly the interface between religion and science, religion and society, so that the AFH becomes a place not only which is the meeting place of religions and of people who want to know about the religions, but a meeting place from which a message from the religions comes out to humanity at large.
So if there's our listenership is always looking for to get involved, they're always looking for, you know, kind of what, you know, all right, so how do I, so if you're remote and you can't travel to the Abrahamic House, if you're looking to get involved, you're looking to get maybe socialized with the concepts that are there in, what would you suggest for someone that's out in the middle of maybe a remote area or maybe not so remote, maybe in a city, just trying to figure out what to do. Multi-faith space is a growth industry, right? So
let me, before I actually answer you, let me tell you that, again, I don't know whether they will listen to me, but I strongly recommend that they provide a virtual visitation, that people can visit the Abrahamic family houses, places of worship, online, because I think that would be very significant to be able to do so. To their credit at the AFH, they limit the amount of people that can visit the complex at any one time. So I think 5 or maybe it's even 6 days a week, there are people visiting the AFH. They can book a visit in advance. They come, and for anybody who can travel to Abu Dhabi, I would strongly recommend them organizing a visit. You just go online, the Abrahamic Family House. You'll see there's a place where you sign up, and you all just organize a visit to take your family along to be able to see this. It's a wonderful experience. I would warmly recommend it. But they also limit the numbers because they don't want this big place becoming first and foremost a tourist place. They want it first and foremost an organic religious location of the 3 different traditions. And therefore, they don't want it overwhelmed by the numbers of tourists, which they could very easily if they were to open it up with limitation. That's why I've strongly encouraged that they should try to have an online visitation, which I think would really be good. I think that's happening more and more in terms of most great places of houses of worship today. You generally can do that. There, first of all, you can connect online anyway and see what information is being provided. There's also a Facebook page in which you can get updates in terms of what's going on there. But I would say broadcast the message. And there are ways in which you could, if you like, simply reflect by getting people together with your own community or across communities to be able to look at the architecture. Look at the message of the architecture, of the beauty and of the setting and of different aspects and what it symbolizes and what it communicates. There is an enormous amount of benefit. And then Abrahamic Family House is above all an idea. It doesn't have to be restricted to its location. The message is, how can you, wherever you are in the world, embody that same spirit? And how can you genuinely encounter another, not from a position of superiority or in any way of patronizing, but out of a genuine desire to be able to know and encounter the other? And there are simple ways to do that. If you haven't done it before, get to know the other's calendar. What are their feasts? What are their celebrations? What do they mean? What are their significance? If you can do it over together, over bubka and coffee, even better. But sometimes there are dietary restrictions. Obviously, if you try and mixing with Orthodox Jews, that's not that simple either in another area. So you've got to be sensitive to that. Get to know lifestyles. There are plenty of videos and material that you can get to be able to discover what it means to be able to have either a wedding within tradition or even a burial within tradition. What does it signify? What do these things mean? And discover one another. Discover one another. Seek to educate yourselves about one another. That, I think, is the greatest gift you can give yourself.
I appreciate the insight, because you know it's the idea of just walking down the street and or talking with your friends, you know, the people that you know. Was a buddy of mine, and we were chatting back and forth. His Christian buddy of mine, and we were chatting about he was feeling a little distant from God, and so I said, well, go back to the source. And he goes, what do you mean by that? And I go, you know, Jesus was a Jew. So, you know, why don't you go and hang out with, go to the synagogue, go just follow the calendar a little bit. And he did it. He spent about 6 months. I said, you know, you got to be careful because you don't want to do it. And this, I hope I don't insult you, embarrass myself. I said, you know, you want to start like with Sukkot, or you want to start with one of the good holidays. You know what I mean? Like, you know, because you get into a Seder, it might, you know, it might be a little bit too much right off the bat, you know? And so, but Rosh Hashanah is a good one. So I go, you know, maybe you start. So, but he did that for about 6 months, and he just circled back to me. He goes, you know, it was a good suggestion. He goes, I never thought about it that way. And I feel closer to Jesus. Now, he's a Christian. He didn't, you know, convert or do anything. And he goes, but how funny is it that, you know, the Muslim told me to do that, and here I am following Muslim instructions to go hang out with the Jewish community to reaffirm my Christian faith. And so I think that those simple things of being able to utilize what you already have, you know, the tools you already have at your disposal that you may not be thinking about. And I grew up in a Jewish community, so I was heavily socialized with all kinds of other stuff. And I think it's always an interesting way to figure out who, maybe reaffirm who you are by interacting with someone to figure out, oh my God, we have all these similarities. It is closer to the source, you know, and I feel closer to that source. But I appreciate you taking the time today because it means a lot for our listenership, for me, and I think for the broader idea of the narrative of multi-faith, interfaith engagement, dignity of the human person, for us to talk about what is actually happening, what's something that's been birthed and functioning and is living and breathing, like you said, an organism. And it's something that we have access to socialize with. So I appreciate you taking the time today. Thank you so much,
Beth. Great pleasure. Thank you. God bless. So.